SiriusXM Sports presents
At the Races with Steve Bick.
Horse racing, handicapping,
interviews.
This is At the Races with Steve Bick.
Unbelievable. Leon Blushewicz, everybody, and just so much fun, and obviously off air continued, but we'll get Blue back this summer again, and I'll publish the crab cake recipe as well. And where you eating? Where you eating when you the next couple of nights? Where you heading? All right, we'll be there tomorrow night. At Prime Rib. Nice. You going to Timonium? You going to be at the sale? All right. Well, they canceled today. They canceled the Breeze show today because of the wet conditions, and they're going to do today's session on Sunday.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah, so you can go back on Sunday. Oh, you got one in here? Yeah. Unbelievable. Tony Black is in the background here. Tony, good morning.
Yeah, good morning. And man, I'll tell you what, if you hear Blue for the first time or the umpteenth time, it's tremendously entertaining. I enjoyed his commentary on so many interesting subjects and brought up the names of so many interesting people and horses. I mean, guy has to have a book out there. If he doesn't already, better have one soon. You know, we need reading about the days of racing when it was embraced by so many. We need to read about that. You know, Hardtack. I rode with Hardtack. I rode for Downey Bonsall. I rode a horse for Downey Bonsall one day at Delaware Park. He says, Jock, all you got to do is guide him around here. Horse's name was Mongongo. Not Mongo, but Mongongo. It was an offspring. And his first time, I think it was on the turf. I'm not even sure if it was his first time. He says, oh, just guide him around here. He'll be an easy winner. He didn't tell me he would try to bolt in the first turn and try to bolt in the second turn. Got him around the first turn, okay. Come to the second turn. I think I finished closer to the outside fence than the middle of the track and win anyway. Mongongo, grass. Delaware Park. I forget the year because they all run together. But he brought back a lot of memories when he saw Ambassador Luck and Snowplow, you know, run against her and horses like that and the guys that he's named are icons in racing. And what a great point to finish it up with Turner. How do you not have a guy like him in the Hall of Fame? You know, great point.
I don't know if you heard Steve Askin, and Steve will be with us later, but Steve's been trying to get My Juliet in, Tony.
Yeah,
and she belongs in, and it. What happens is if certain horses and certain riders and certain people don't get in when there's a collection of voters that were, you know, particularly involved in that period or overlapped it,
right.
It gets hard. There's clearly the situation with Craig Perrett, where the current voter block is really unaware of a period in the game's history when you didn't necessarily run up huge totals. I mean, you don't have to win. You know, Edgar, we talked yesterday about his 7,000th. You don't have to run up totals as a trainer or a rider to be Hall of Fame worthy. I mean, it was a different era, and I don't know how you transfer an understanding about, you know, certain horsemen and certain riders to voters in a situation like that.
Yeah, you're right on. I mean, the current committees don't have that ability to look back because they didn't live in that era, or they weren't familiar with that era of jockey or of horse, you know. And when you talk about Perrette and My Juliet and Mongo, I think he said Mongo, wasn't it? Is Mongo not in the Hall of Fame?
I'm not sure.
I mean, and you know, and you either were a kid witnessing their performances, or you had that era kind of in the back of your mind. Sometimes the only thing those horses and the people that owned them and the jocks that rode in that era have to look back on, well, you know, because some of the fond memories they have to look back on is that era. And being in the Hall of Fame is a significant part of that horse's performance or that jock's performance, Craig Perrett. I mean, look, what a guy, you know? Had a unique personality, sometimes tough to deal with. You know, he wasn't out there schmoozing every trainer and owner out there, but had the talent where they came and got him and they wanted him to ride, horses of the upper caliber horses, because he was a great performer. Should be in the Hall of Fame, absolutely. You know, and sometimes that's all the rider or that person has to look back on, or the connections of that horse has to look back on is, well, you know what? We did it. It might be forgotten, but or not be current, but they're in the Hall of Fame, and you know that's important. It's important when you look back at a career and you deservingly need to be considered for such an honor.
Part of that, Tony, may also, with a horse like him, it also may be that he came from an era where the turf horse is less.
Right.
It was less heralded. I mean, a horse like Round Table, who is America's first, you know, really notable turf champion, Round Table had plenty of exploits on the main track. Just don't put him on a wet track. But he was successful enough on the main track that circumvented limits as a turf horse. Mongo, though, while I think he did win on the main track, I is remembered much more as a turf horse.
Absolutely, and like you say, a lot of times though, the horses that were turf horses, even if they did run, you know, maybe lesser races on the dirt, but they won their premier races were on the turf. They're not thought as highly of as a dirt horse, especially in that era. And you know what? And even in a more current era, there was a period of time where people thought, well, he couldn't run on the dirt, and his last resort was to try him on the turf, so he excelled a little bit on the turf. You know, that was a last resort. He wasn't a great horse. It was just a last resort, and he was the best of those bad horses that couldn't run on the dirt, and they ran on the turf. But Mongo, I mean, Frank Bonzel and guys that had horses like that, I mean, they're legends. They are legends, Mongo, just like Blue's a legend. He's an amazing guy with the stories that, you know, he can tell. And you know what's really, really refreshing? He tells these stories, and say, you know, at that time I was broke, or, you know, there's no frills about it. We were down on our last penny, or, you know, he isn't trying to act like he's something that he wasn't or something that he isn't. He's just telling it like it was. And his story reflects the story of so many people that have been on the racetrack since the, you know, 40s, 30s, 40s, 50s. We left out one rider in the era of 40s and 50s and 60s. And, of course, I have to say his name because he started in Maryland. Sam Bolmides, my uncle, 1948, started in Maryland. There was some fight promoter that said, kid, you'll never be a fighter. But you know what? You might be a jockey. And he took him to the racetrack, and there's where he started riding in Maryland in 1948. So, Sam Bolmides, I'm proud of you. Look what you did for me. You brought me into a business I would have known nothing about if I didn't live on your farm for quite a few years and be under your influence. Thanks, Uncle Sam. That's the Uncle Sam I can thank. There was a time or two I couldn't thank the other Uncle Sam. Because as many racetrackers, he was down our throats. And we had an ordeal to straighten that out. But luckily, we know we get smart and we start paying attention to Uncle Sam.
Well, and Tony, you actually kind of helped me bring up the topic that you and I were kind of bouncing back and forth off air, and the kind of boiling over of some of these animosities between the Guild and between the jocks in New York, and obviously it goes beyond, you know, just the contract negotiations between the riders and Naira. It's much bigger than that, and some of the topics, as Naira has pointed out, and rightly, that some of them are issues that need to be addressed nationally, including that scale of weights discussion. And I made the point, when it came to that in particular, that even the riders themselves, and this is what to me is kind of a a fly in the ointment. The jocks themselves aren't unified on some of these topics, including the concussion protocol and being told they can't ride versus making their own decision, you know, the whole independent contractor versus, you know, being under the umbrella of car. That kind of topic. Yeah, I heard a little bunk.
Yeah.
You know, some of the issues that internally, Tony, that riders are not in agreement on. I mean, what you obviously haven't had to deal with this in the Guild in particular, but your thoughts on what we're reading and hearing.
Okay. First off, I've been on different sides of the fence with the Guild, and as really when it came to Terry Meeks, what didn't embrace him when he took it over, and, you know, we still have our differences. Actually formed an organization at Parks, which when the Guild went belly up, that stepped in, and at least we helped these jocks and got access to some money for them at Parks. When we're talking about some of the issues that are national and some of the issues that are in New York, I'm going to go down a list. Number one, the weight issue, we resolved that at Parks and in New Jersey. You can resolve that without it being a national forum. You can resolve that issue by going to the racing secretary, as we did. I think it was Sal Sinatra, not Jim Beam. We said, these horses are getting in with 12 and 13. Nobody can do it. It's tough for these lightweights. And let's do something about it. So I think it was Sal. I don't want to say for sure because it was quite a few years ago. He says, yeah, we can do something. And what you do is you take the weight and make it a higher weight on the top end, and the racing secretary gauges all the races. He puts the book out based on whatever you consider the top weight, 22, 23, 24, whatever you're going to make it. And at Parks, nothing gets in lighter than 16. And in Jersey, I believe it was done also at Jersey. But we did it through the racing office with the racing secretary, and they have the right to do that. It doesn't have to be National Racing Commission rule. It can be done at that particular track. So you can raise the weights. You can do it in New York. You could do it in, like we did at Parks, and you can ensure that no horse will get in lighter than 16. And, of course, jocks aren't always unified on that because you'll have a couple of light jocks that can do 10 or 12, and,
right,
and you're affecting their business. But that's not what you key in on. You focus in on what the room and the person that has his thumb on the pulse of the jocks room wants and the majority of the riders want. And I'm sure Johnny Velasquez has his thumb on the pulse of the jocks room in New York and can get it done. And Johnny's no super lightweight, you know. These guys, if the bottom weight was 16, it would definitely be to the majority. Maybe there's two riders up there that can do lighter than that, but the majority of riders, and that's what you're dealing with. That's number one on the weights. It can be done internally at that racetrack. We did it. When it comes to when it comes to New York, you know, I sense, because I've talked to a few riders that were up there and that are up there now, and I'm not going to mention names, there's a little tension between riders and New York at this particular time. And I've gotten this feedback from a couple guys. And then one of them sent me something, and it was a post that the NYRA put up. It was it's the actual post. It says, NYRA Racing, attention horsemen. Both Florent Giroux, Tyler Bays will be available for mounts on Saturday, 5/12/18. Well, you know what? If there's tension amongst jocks, what is a racing association, which I've been on many racetracks and a lot of years, and I've never witnessed a racing establishment advertising as an agent for any particular jock. One time I did, and you know who the jock was? It was Bill Shoemaker. When he was going on his farewell tour, there would be a post put out by the management or the racing association that says, Bill Shoemaker will be here at whatever day it would be, and it's his farewell tour. But where does a racing association act as an agent for any, or mention any jockeys in association with New York Racing Association, especially if there's already a tension between jockeys and management? And what are you trying to do, rub some salt in the wound? I mean, it's not really the right thing to do at any time, let alone if there's a little tension there. When it comes to, you know, we were talking yesterday, even about CTE, concussion, you know, and here's the whole thing. When the NFL put concussion protocol in place, they didn't go to the running back or the wide receiver and say, you guys want concussion protocol put in place? They said, we see a lot of guys that are victims of concussion, CTE, you know, chronic traumatic encephalopathy. We see them walking around and, you know, they're mentally disabled. You know, there's a lot of mental disability in the NFL of old retired players. It's been diagnosed. Some of them, after they died, it was diagnosed. But they didn't go to the NFL, didn't go and say, do you guys want it? They said, this is what we're doing. It's for everybody's benefit. You don't go to a jockey and say, this could be detrimental to your business. Do you want it? You say, listen, son, this is what we're doing. On top of that, it's more important to have it done in racing. If an NFL player goes out there and has been concussed on a couple games several times, you know, he's affecting himself. If I go out there, and I'm sure I've gone out there, or someone's gone out there that hit the ground doing 35 miles an hour, got up, sometimes their helmet stays on, sometimes it doesn't, they got up, they walked back to the room or got an ambulance ride back to the room, the clerk of scale says, oh, you want to take off or are you riding the next races you're on? Well, yeah, I'll ride the next one. Well, that's just generally speaking. The worst concussion I had, the only reason I didn't go back to the jocks room and ride the next race was I had a broken pelvis, a broken L1, L2, a broken thumb, and a severe concussion. Spent 4 days in the hospital. When I got out of the hospital 5 months later, after the doctor who visited me from the track in the hospital had asked me to sign my name in the hospital, when I got back to the track 5 months later and went back to riding, he took me in and he did a, you know, just a quick test and he said, sign your name. And he showed me, I told you this story before, you're probably tired of hearing it. But he said, sign your name. I signed my name. He said, you see what you signed when you were in the hospital? I said, what is it? He said, that's your name. He said, you know, I think with Merlin taking the forefront and going and starting to put a database, you know, a baseline database in place for jockeys, and going to address the protocol for concussion, I think New York, our premier race state, and every track eventually, but our premier race state, New York, you know, should already have been on the forefront of doing this. Merlin's doing it. They say when you go to Keeneland, there's even something that they do now. I guess maybe they try to form a quick baseline. I mean, it's going to cost to do these things, but it has to be done. Because if a jockey goes out there and he just messes himself up because he's concussed is one thing. But how about the 6, 7, 5, 10 horses behind him? What if he drops 4 or 5 of them?
Well, at least in
the NFL, you're not going to drop somebody.
But that seems to be the debate, Tony, and the issue,
it's invalid.
But the question about being responsible for the potential outcomes. That's one of the cruxes within this discussion, apparently. But I don't disagree with you. I mean, but at the same time, the jocks, I mentioned it yesterday. I mean, the guy that takes a spill in the third race on an important Saturday and has got, you know, mounts in $500,000 million races later on the card. It's hard to hold them back. And
as long as there's a professional baseline that's been established and he cannot qualify to meet the standards of that
baseline,
you take him off, Steve. It's too bad.
All right,
bad.
That's fine with me. It's fine
it's
with me.
Bad. That's just the way it's got to be.
All right. All right.
The more you smooth them and tell them, oh, well, we don't want to hurt your business, they'll stand there and they'll say, yeah, I was all right to ride. We had a jock get a spill on a spill, Michael Sanchez at Parks, right? And they said they weren't going to let him ride. I says, well, I'll tell you what. And you know what? And this is an issue I have. The LAS helmets and the champion helmets, they got a chin strap that does absolutely nothing. I've seen more jocks hit the ground and they land one place and the helmet lands another. I've changed all my LAS helmets and put more a concave chin strap that's more like a football helmet chin strap on my helmets because it can't come off if you have this football helmet chin strap on. The chin straps that come through the factory with these helmets are worthless. They're useless. If you have to choke yourself and have it so tight And it's still, if it slides forward, which it will because it doesn't fit into your chin, the helmet flies off. Michael Sanchez, he fell. It was the next few days were dark days. He went to, they said they weren't going to let him ride on Saturday. I said, well, that's, you know, that's understandable, Mike. He says, well, I went to the doctor. The doctor said, there's always a possibility of a concussion because your helmet came off. He said, so the doctor made me a neurology appointment. I went to the neurologist. I said, do you have the report from the neurologist? He says, yeah. He said, there's no sign of anything that could be considered a concussion. I says, well, show it to Sam Elliott, and you've got 3 or 4 days to produce this. Make sure you have the doctor's note and the neurology note. I says, but everybody wants a ride once they hit the ground, unless they break something. He says, no, Tone, I'm all right. He says, I really am. He says, and here's the neurologist. You can talk to him. So we went round and round, got all the information. Sam was trying to do the right thing, and he said, I don't know, his helmet came up, blah, 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 you know, and there's a concussion protocol in place. I says, Sam, I told this jock's agent, there's no concussion protocol in place. The Guild doesn't have it in place. They're working on getting it in place. But these tracks are reluctant to put it in place because of the argument they're worried about a jock's business. Don't worry about a jock's business. Worry about what he could do if he went out there and he was in la-la land and dropped 3 or 4. And that's the end of the argument, and you tell jockeys what they're going to do. You don't ask them. They didn't ask NFL players what they wanted. They told them what they're going to do. And that's the way it's got to be. And I really have deep-seated opinion and a reason for thinking this, because I know I've had several concussions. And I don't want to see kids wind up where they're impaired mentally or possibly hurt themselves further or, worse than that, hurt or kill somebody. And maybe we're real sensitive right now because in the last 8 years we've had 2 riders succumb to spills that caused their death at Philly.
Right.
You don't ask riders. You tell them. You know, there's certain things you can ask them about. You know, when it comes to management, generally speaking, managements listen to jockeys with the attitude, here they are complaining. And this will lead on to the other New York part. And if we listen and make believe we're paying it, but we ignore it long enough, maybe it'll go away. And that's sometimes the attitude that you get or you feel you get from management. Now, I'm never wanting to cancel or hold up racing, but holding up racing is not the end of the world. And I think they made a point when Johnny Velasquez took the riders and they went to Panza and they stated their grievances and made them clear. You know, like I said, Johnny's got his finger on the pulse of the jockeys in the jockeys room. There was an issue with, I talked to a jock up there with the turf race, where they keep carding 10 horse field in this configuration of the turf course. I believe it's, he said, at Belmont, I think it is. Belmont? Yeah, Belmont. He says, he says, 10 horses is too many to run in this particular race on the turf. The configuration doesn't support that size field. I said, well, we have issues like that at parks. A flat mile going into the first turn, we don't run big fields. And 5/8 of a mile, we run 8 horse fields going into the 3/8 pole because, you know, it eliminates an unnecessary danger. You know, the other thing I have when it comes to when I was told the jockeys, they have 3 racetracks up there and several training tracks. When it comes to the rail configurations, they've had 20 to 30 years to change those rails. They've changed 3 of them is what I understand, to the Duralock and a better rail system than what they initially had. There's tracks that are not premier racetracks in the country that have the best safety rail available, the Fontana or one of the other safety rails or the Duralocks on all their racetracks. When the NTRA certifies safety of a racetrack and gives it a certificate of safety, one of the systems that should be on the top of the list of being safety, being the most safe it could be, is your rail system. If you have training tracks that are not the highest quality and race tracks, the performance track, highest quality rail system, how do you get certified from the NTRA? And what does the NTRA do to monitor these situations? I've been at tracks where you never see a representative come out there and make sure that they haven't become complacent. you know, that the NTRA is on top of maintaining and making sure that these tracks don't become complacent and let their safety compliance.
Well, they have to, when they get reaccredited, that's the checkup process.
Yeah, but they don't get reaccredited every year. From what, you know, it's an accreditation that, you know, you kind of lose sight of after a period of time. And when it comes to ambulances, I was told by a jock, there was a boy last week, an exercise rider that had a head injury, severe head injury. He wound up going to the hospital and having to get brain surgery. They said the ambulance response, and usually, you know, you always say, oh, the ambulance response was real slow. He says, no, Tone, it was real slow. He says, in fact, the ambulance driver didn't know what area to go to when he was called to the area. He wasn't familiar with the locations. Well, that should be standard in the, I mean, with modern technology and everything that's out there for GPSs to put in a printed sheet out there, this is the area, this is what it's called, this is Oklahoma, this is that, and this is where you go and how you get there if there's an emergency. And it shouldn't be some other union employee helping them raise the gurney and put it on the ambulance. This jock person witnessed it. He said it wasn't even, and it was an EMT. Maybe there was a paramedic. He says, I'm not sure, but it was an EMT that drove the ambulance from what he told me. Now, I'm giving you hearsay and secondary information. I'm not saying it's God's word, but it's from pretty good source. And it shouldn't be someone that's working in maintenance or track superintendent that helps them load the gurney. You know, there should be adequately staffed ambulances with paramedics. The ambulance doesn't follow the field or monitor races or what goes on in the morning for show. They're there for a reason. It's a hazardous, dangerous sport. You know, and maybe it's coming to light because in 2010 we had a boy get killed at parks in the morning. The EMTs couldn't do anything to provide any medical assistance to him. All they could do is load him up until the Ben Salem police came there, and they performed a tracheotomy on him, which should have been performed much earlier. They got him to the hospital. He died anyway. Then we went to Sal at that time, Victor Molina and I, and we said, we need paramedics on the ambulance. We were told that the EMTs were useless. They can't do anything but transport. We had paramedics. Do you know when Jose Flores fell the other day, and sometime in 2016, and I have this confirmed till the person that confirmed it left, he says, up to 2015, I was in the as a track superintendent, and you had paramedics there. I says, well, how come the other day you're not here anymore? There was EMTs on the ambulance. They couldn't do anything but transport him. He says, they were there when I left town. And I mean, everybody can put two and two together and tell you who I'm talking about. But we had paramedics. But places get tracks and management get complacent. And they don't realize what could happen till it happens. And my whole take on it is, let's do the best job we could possibly do to make everyone on that backside, whether it's jockeys, exercise boys, hot walkers, trainers, grooms, as safe as possible and can get the medical attention needed if some accident does occur. Not after it occurs and someone dies, oh, yeah, we're going to get paramedics back on the ambulance. Well, the last time we got them on in 2010, it only lasted to 2015. You know, 8 years later, somebody gets killed.
No, well, and there's the checks. It's a fair point about the checks and balances. I don't think Parks is part of the accreditation plan.
No,
as it happens.
It isn't. In fact, when I was at the track superintendent symposium a couple years ago, at the time there was a man. I'm trying to think of his name. Oh, what the hell? I got his he was part of the accreditation process. Ziegler, Mr. Ziegler.
Mike Ziegler, he's at Churchill.
Yeah, he's not there. Oh, and I love Churchill, especially that stock voice, done great. But not to change the subject. I couldn't believe it yesterday. But anyway, Mr. Ziegler said, I sent your man. I says, because he was at the track superintendent's meeting in 2015. I sent your man all the accreditation papers and process and, they've been there for, he meant Sam Elliott. He says they've been there for a month, and I have heard nothing back. I says, well, I don't know how he's my man. You know, I don't know whose man he is, but I've got nothing to say in that matter, and I'm sure he'll respond. Well, he never did respond, from what I understand. And now Mr. Ziegler's no longer, like you said, he's at Churchill. And, you know, he's no longer part of that process. But you're right. Parks is not accredited. You are absolutely right.
It's this is a tough topic, I knew I had to cover it with you. You know, with the proximity to what went on, these last
and you know what, Steve,
so.
I'm so long-winded. I have to give you a break, and
that's
know
all right.
You've got a multitude of people, topics to discuss, and I'm going to let you go because I'm breaking out in a sweat talking to you,
Tony. Finally, though, your Preakness thought.
I think it'll be easiest winner for Justify, and it's a toss-up with the rest of it. That track doesn't possibly accommodate good magic, but, you know, he looks like the other class horse, but I think Justify will be his easiest win for him. On those flat turns at Pimlico, because he'll be in front with the momentum, and anybody else will have to catch him. And he's got a great post. What is he, 7 in the
7.
A-horse field?
Yeah.
He's got the horse to beat on the inside of him. He's got a great post, and all he'll have to do is let his horse coast around that bottom turn, come to the head of the stretch, and before you know it, he'll be in front at the wire under wraps. Everybody else will be trying to pick up momentum around that flat turn. They're not tight turns. They're flat.
There you go, from somebody who won a lot of races right out here at Old Hilltop on the ovals of Pimlico. Tony, I appreciate it, and we'll keep following up on the topic. Thank you.
Bye.
We'll stay right here, though. Marty McGee is sitting across from me, and this is always one of our fun conversations, and Marty's still suffering from the residual of your little flu bug 3 weeks ago.
About 3 weeks, that's right.
Yeah.
How you doing, Bick?
Unbelievable. I come here, I gave you something to read, and today's going to be too short for me to read. I had toyed with reading to everybody, but I find stuff in this room every year, Marty, that to me is just remarkable. Then I had Leon Blushewitz here, live and in person, for an hour, and it was impossible not to just let Blue run wild. That there's Blue
as a younger gentleman
with Doc Severinsen, gave him a trumpet. He was training for Doc. The filly is bluer than blue, and we had a tremendous fun. But I find things, and yesterday I discover the queen of the Maryland turf, Wilhelmina Truman, who came to the racetrack in 1905 and stayed 80 years.
I don't remember anything about her. I saw where you put that on Twitter, and they said there was a Wilhelmina Stakes.
Yeah, the Queen Wilhelmina purse, and they ran it at Bowie.
Okay. Well, Bowie's last year was 85, my first year. I was here for the last Bowie meet. I actually got one of those little vials that they had as key holders with Bowie dirt in them.
Wow.
They gave away to everybody. I don't know if I still have it or not.
Well, I hope you do.
I hope I do, too.
You didn't sell it on eBay.
Actually, the lettering had faded within a few years. It was kind of a cheap plastic thing, and you couldn't really, I don't know if it said Bowie anymore or not.
It was a tchotchke, a trinket.
Yeah.
Well, that tickled me to no end. She was the oldest female trainer in the country for years and years and years. They ran a stake on her birthday every year. I discovered an article by Tom White of the Baltimore News Post. It was a Thoroughbred Racing Association prize winner in 1958, and it's a story. I guarantee you, if I go down to Coley Blind and to George Ann Hale and the oldest people I can find on this racetrack, they know the story of Pimlico Barney, the fire dog, which I tell every year is my favorite. You know, you've seen the gravestone in the corner.
I don't know that I've seen it.
I'll take you to Pimlico Barney's grave. It's okay. One of the greatest stories, one of the greatest. The greatest racetrack stories anywhere all seem to be here. This is a story of a trainer from Charlestown, and it's funny that this came up because
Ferris Allen the other day. Ferris Allen and Woodbury Payne and myself and Aaron Yagoda, and we had who else was there? Bill Reitler was there, and oh my gosh, I don't want to draw a blank. Jim Harris was there with us, and Dick Dutrow's name came up, and Ferris Allen was talking about trainers trying to come from Charlestown to the big circuit. And Ferris Allen did it, and Dick Dutrow did it, and there aren't too many others.
There weren't.
That could make that transition.
Now, this fellow that is you're referring to here in this article, his name was Dill Gray. And it says he was a half miler.
Yeah.
So I inferred that to mean Cumberland and Hagerstown and Havre de Grace and all those.
And the bull rings. I mean, he from basically from, you know, Western Maryland, you know, people know that Charlestown is in West Virginia, but it might as well be in Maryland. It's literally yards over the border.
Well, you also have to slice through Virginia for about, I don't know, half a mile, and then you get into, yeah. I made that trip up and back 340 quite a bit when I used to live here.
Well, and for those that have never been to Charlestown, you're also, you may stop one night in a hotel, and I basically went out to Charlestown to go to the Charlestown Classic one year on my way to Derby.
And John Service, by the way, another Charlestown trainer, made it big.
There you go.
All right, keep going.
But you wake up and you realize you're in Antietam. It's right there. And so that is an overwhelming experience beyond description, frankly. And they say when you go for, I forget what, not a holiday, but there's a day where they light those little smudge pots
to commemorate a certain date
of the battle. Mm-hmm. And they say it's just the most amazing scene. But this story, Dill Gray, and he died in 1949 at a young age, 55. In 1949 in April, and his daughter, he had always talked about wanting to make the big time in Maryland racing, and his daughter got permission and by candlelight, by flashlight
and moonlight,
they buried him. They buried his urn in the infield
underneath the flagpole or next to the flagpole.
There's no marker. As opposed to, you know, there's a lot of different things at racetracks, whether it's horses, whether it's some, you know, some humans, actually. There's some pets, famously, that are buried in infields. And no, I guarantee you no one has, that everyone has forgotten this story. And Tom White wrote this story in 1958, May 16th, which is
60 years ago yesterday.
Yeah, that's when I found it.
Yeah.
It's unbelievable. I'll put this up, and I think people will find it really moving. And it ends with a line from Robert Louis Stevenson from Requiem. "This be the verse you grave for me. Here he lies where he longed to be." And it was basically someone who couldn't make it to the big time, but got in his eternal rest a chance to be here. And it's so achingly sweet that I got to make sure it lives on, because otherwise it would have died in these files here.
I'm glad they have these files. You know, Churchill, about 15 years ago, they just mindlessly trashed a lot of their archives.
Well, an individual. There was an individual associated with that.
Yeah. So, that's quite something we'll never... I guess you could go to public libraries.
Well, the Keeneland Library, yeah. which has got a repository. But luckily, there's human repositories of this knowledge, like Leon Blushewitz and like you. And it's always fun, because when we come here, and because so many, you know, think of you from your winters down in Florida, and more importantly, from being in the Ville, being in Kentucky. But you cherished your time here.
It was great. It was my coming of age. March 10th, 1985. I walked in with a coat and tie just like you're wearing, and started a calling charge for the Sports Eye, the would be competitor to the
and now it's in the fold.
Racing Forum. Yeah, now we're me and Erwin Cohen and everybody else is in the fold.
It's pretty funny.
I worked with a guy named Kelso Sturgeon, the third.
Oh, sure, of course.
And his dad was somewhat iconic around here.
Absolutely.
But I was the chart caller, and Kelso was my chart taker and call taker. And ultimately, in a few months, the sports I folded, and Dale Austin and Chicky Lang were most instrumental in getting me on with the Sun, mostly Dale. Chicky and Chick both tried I would go over to Bowie, and Chicky would say, I still don't have anything for you yet. But then Dale hired me on as a handicapper in July of 85 for the Sun, and I was off and running. And Dale would be off on various missions, and I would be kind of one guy cannot do a horse racing beat on a circuit like this. So I started getting my name out there more and more, and Dale left for the Racing Times, another would-be competitor to the Racing Forum in 91, and so I was the columnist for that last year, and then that was at the time when Ross Petticord was working for the Evening Sun, and Jack Mann was a fabulous writer, and went to 1 year of college, he told me once. And I would hear him over here fighting with his editors, because he would use words nobody had ever heard of, you know, and including educated people. We had never heard of these words. So he would be fighting with, but he and Ross were for the Evening Sun. And then in late 91, early 92, the Sun and Evening Sun consolidated, offered everybody buyouts, and that's when I took it. And a few months later, I was with Daily Racing Form. So I've been with them 26 years now.
And were you out of work? I mean, between the sports eye period what did you do? How did
you know? I endeavored to attempt to do one of these scratch sheets. You can still see them in Louisville. They were big time back then. But now, I'm so glad it wasn't a go. I ended up paying a guy named David Hayden, who had this company and made a mock sheet and tried to set up distribution the way, you know, kind of piggyback the racing for him. And it just wouldn't fly. And you know, over a certain period of time, I was so glad that it didn't. It was just going to be so labor intensive for one, and it was going to be, it just in the age of the internet, it wouldn't go. So I still happen to see the scratch sheet around in Louisville.
Yeah,
but I don't see it anywhere else because they didn't have one here. You know, but ultimately George Burnett got me on at the forum.
George Burnett.
Yeah.
who I got to work with for at least 1 week when I went to Monmouth that year for Breeders' Cup, and he was still working at Monmouth.
He's a beautiful man.
There's another walking repository of history and knowledge.
Yeah. You know what George told me once? Everybody needs an editor. And in this day of the internet, when anybody can just write whatever they want,
yeah.
And I'm thinking George Burnett was right. This guy needs an editor.
That's a great line. George and John White talks about George. I think John worked for him in the Phoenix office maybe at one time.
Yeah. Although I think George is mostly a Jersey guy. I don't know if he ever had to go to Phoenix.
I think he ran a satellite office for a short period maybe.
You know, he used to have big offices in Chicago, L.A., and Phoenix.
Right.
You know, aside from Hightstown. Hightstown was the mothership.
The mothership. Exactly. Marty McGee you can parlay with the best of them when it comes to the history and the storylines, and yet still younger than me though.
By one day. It's pretty remarkable. And Jay Primmons, 16 days.
He's a baby.
Yeah, 16
days. He's the baby. The three of us born 19 days apart.
Class
in 1959.
When the same year that Joe Hirsch founded the National Turf Riders, and there's that big photo out here on the wall.
Yes.
I think that's the inaugural meeting of all those.
Is
people.
That right? That
I'm pretty sure it is. Or I've seen one. I don't know if it's the one out here.
I've got to put up that picture. Now that we've had that conversation, I'm going to put up the picture of Andy Beyer and Bob Harding, Bob Harding. That people loved it. That last year, the last couple of years, I had the Ed Pope picture with Howard Cosell and Billy Reed. Billy, that turned up on his Facebook page. He was thrilled to have a chance to see that again. I'm telling you, this is. For me, it's very special. I get misty. It's misty outside, nonstop. And what's your take on what we're going to deal with here? Tomorrow and Saturday are going to be a little
a little difficult.
Already off the grass. They had five races on the grass today. Tomorrow they're talking about running with the rail 20 feet out on the grass. There's a number of stakes on Friday, too. And then when they run the Saturday stakes on the turf, hopefully they will take the turf race down, and as George Ann Hale said, so that we can have some virgin ground closest to the hedge. So, you know, I was talking to a number of people who have horses cross-entered in both the Murphy and the Sir Barton.
Yes.
And what they want to happen is have the race come off and stay in as the easier as the counterpart to the Sir Barton, because the Sir Barton has Axeman and Pony Up as clear-cut favorites in that race. And so what they'd want to do is, like, have the grass horses, you know, go away in the Murphy and have the main track to themselves. So.
Well, on that topic, since you brought up the way the card unfolds, I got to ask you, did you find the race selection a little strange, the way the card winds down tomorrow, Saturday, up to Preakness?
I'm always accustomed to, like, the Manhattan to the Belmont and the early time, or the Old Forester to the...
Look at you, you're two bourbons behind.
the Old Forester to the Derby, you know, what the Dixie is to the Preakness. But no, it does not directly precede the Preakness. It's somewhere else in that mix, and we've got the Sir Barton as the lead-in race.
The Dixie's at 2:07. It's early on the card. It wasn't like it's a tiny field, unless they were worried
that it was going to scratch down to nothing
if they had to take it off. But in the meantime, they put the 14-horse The very one. Exactly.
That's a George Burnett original, by the way.
Is that right?
Yeah, the very one. So.
Because people think that the horse was called Very One.
Yeah.
No. No.
Her name was the very one. So it's the very one stakes.
Well, and in there, Chantelaine, Girls Know Best and Just Talking are going to get you through that leg. But maybe that's the concern, is that if somehow it comes off and they end up, or even the soft turf limits the horses that would have run in the Dixie. For those that haven't had a chance to see the card, you've got four allowance races that start Saturday. Then the Murphy is the first stake race of the day at 12:51, race five. Then there's an allowance, and there's a horse in there. I thought Cal Lynch's horse was at 5-1. Belfour looked very, very likable. Then the Dixie, the Chick Lang, Hirsch Jacobs, I find that just ridiculous. You could have named the Maryland Sprint the Chick Lang, but instead we're going to pave over Hirsch Jacobs' memory. The Gallarette, where Cambodia looks to repeat, and you've got Christophe Clement with a new North American invader, Blessed Silence, a French filly, Elise's World in there for Chad as well. Then the Maryland Sprint and the very one, and then the Sir Barton and the Preakness.
Well, I guess they thought the Sir Barton as a dirt race would hold together no matter and it's got a field of 11. But you know, I'm going to make the over under 6.5 on how many are in there.
Really, you think they'll abandon ship?
Gary's going to scratch it, both of his, so that's 9.
Capuano,
Then Maker wouldn't commit either way. And Lacey said she wants the race. She wants to stay in the Murphy, and run in the off the turf. Yeah, run in the off the turf Murphy and scratch out of the Sir Barton. And then you've got, like I said, you got two pretty strong favorites in there. And Axeman, he looks like he's 4-5, and Pony Up looks like he's 9-5. And so you'll probably have two, you know, long shots come on out of there too. So yeah.
Well, and the horses that Mart is mentioning, Threes Over Deuces and Whirlin' Curlin', those are the two Gary Capuano cross-entered. Maker is also cross-entered with California Knight, and he's a price in either race no matter what happens. But actually, California Knight, if the race comes off tomorrow, the Murphy...
looks like he's okay. And so does Threes Over Deuces. Looks like he's okay in the Murphy.
Yeah. So, FYI on that. The 5, 7, and 8 are the two cross-enters from the Murphy.
And also Takedown, the Luch horse for Lacey Gaudette.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, so there's four of them.
Four of them. Yeah. Well, and that race, you know, Tap Daddy and Colton Mississippi, both major players, Say the Word for Grand Motion.
that magical Meister who won the Battaglia and then struggled in Jeff Ruby in here for Jim Chapman as well. Let's talk about Preakness and your thoughts after the draw. The coincidence of Justify getting the 7-hole, which he launched from in the Derby.
I mean, Keith Fiesel stays with me in Louisville. He and I go back to the 92. Actually, we go back to these rooms right here. His grandfather, Cecil Kaufman. I'm talking about Keith Fiesel, the line maker for the Maryland tracks. His grandfather, Cecil Kaufman, was the mutual clerk here in the press box. So, Keith was a little wet behind the ears teenager when he first started coming around, and he ended up working for Figs Form.
You
remember that thing?
Eddie Fontaine.
It was like reading, hieroglyphics. So anyway, that lasted.
I've got a copy of Figs Form at home.
That died quicker than the Racing Times and the Sports Eye. So anyway, Keith was we were talking right after the Derby. You know, what price is he going to make Justify? And so we settled on 4 to 5 if Good Magic was in there, 3 to 5 or maybe 1 to if Good Magic wasn't in there, we said 1 to 5. So I think he's gonna be 40 cents on the dollar, because after justifying Good Magic, how can you really bet with much confidence on anything to win? I mean, how can you? That's why he's got it 12 to 1 and 15 to 1 after that. So I'm gonna try again to beat Justify, even though it's probably futile. I admit it up front. What's the race strategy going to be, number one? I mean, is Quip going to go out there and be a rabbit for
I don't think
Justify?
I don't think he's a rabbit, but I think he's got no choice about it. From the one, he's got to go.
But if he's really, and he's going to be fresh, so he's probably going to show some speed. I mean,
doesn't Diamond King jump on him?
I don't know if he's fast enough. I really don't. I think Quip's a pretty good horse, but Justify can probably outrun them all, but to what degree does Smith want to, go ahead and clear off? I mean, I just think that Jose Ortiz is going to likely sit a pretty good trip, and maybe, this happens every day, Steve, in horse racing. You find 2.5 or 3 lengths to reverse the – what happened one day doesn't necessarily have to happen the next. So that's my theory in trying to beat Justify. Cold 5.72 is my try.
Lone Sailor, your third horse, and Lone Sailor's made a nice appearance. And Amos clearly saw an opportunity after the hubbub coming Sunday after Derby, and wondering if maybe he could take advantage. One thing he may get an advantage here is pace. It does feel like, even though there isn't breakaway speed, there's again a number of horses that are going to be at least involved, and that could boil over a little bit.
It could. I mean, it might just be like it was here 3 years ago with American Pharoah. He went out there and just won, So
that's Baffert's MO. I mean, in terms of not taking any chances and just controlling it up front if possible.
Yeah, and I'm sure he's glad he got outside. Smith has all – he can do whatever he wants. Just sit there and look to your left, and it's, steer him around there. So, I think he'll be 2 to 5 or so, and most likely will win. If I'm trying to think of – the scenario whereby Good Magic just gets up there and collars him and goes by him. It's kind of hard to do, but it could happen.
Do you think there's the opportunity? I mean, if we certainly speculated enough at Derby about, because he is a big horse and because he has had occasion to, not break in stride, that if somehow Good Magic is ahead of him after a couple of jumps, do you think Jose Ortiz tries to maintain that position?
Ooh.
That is the other interesting element.
That's very interesting.
Right?
That would change the whole dynamic.
Absolutely.
And then you're going to have Drew on the one sitting looking over his right shoulder trying to figure out what the rest of them are doing. So it's a pretty interesting race, even though it does look like a two-horse race.
What's your take on the two Lucas horses? Which one is more bettable or less bettable?
I think there's more potential for Sporting Chance to harken back to his you know, his grade one form and maybe run good. Of course, he was reluctant to train Sunday morning.
Yeah.
And that's straight from the clockers' mouths. That's from a couple of the clockers that, because I wasn't there yet. It happened like 5:45 or whatever. And but he would have to run back to his best form. Bravazo's just kind of been a, I don't know, who were the two interchangeable horses Wayne had a few years ago? Sky something and who were the? I get them all confused. He had
I'm
like
trying to think of who you mean.
He had one of them pay a $50 in the Dixie here one year, and there was another horse who was running at the same time. He's just kind of a mid-packer type, you know, like Eddie. You know Eddie Gray, who works for the
sure.
He's kind of a land rush. Eddie Gray, one year, it was the year that Hansel won the Preakness here, and I was still riding for the Sun, and in. So that was 91, and in 89, of course, you were either on the Easy Goer team or the Sunday Silence team, and in 1990, you were either on the Summer Squall team or the Unbridled team. And so I said I didn't want to stick with one horse because I picked Hansel in the Derby, and he was horrible. And so he comes here and won the Preakness, and I said, well, I didn't want to be one of those guys who just sticks to the same horse. And Eddie goes, well, I did it last year, and he was referring to 1990. I said, well, who'd you have? Do you have Unbridled or Summer Squall? And he said, no, I had Land Rush. And it was some Lucas, no name. You know,
well,
he ran in all three races. And I'm like, who would have picked Land Rush in the Derby and the Preakness and the Belmont? So I fell on the floor laughing, you know.
Like, my Lucas horse on that is Lost Mountain.
Okay.
Lost Mountain.
That was a long time
ago. Lost Mountain and Yonder. Yeah, I loved Yonder.
Mm.
I thought Yonder was a Derby winner.
Was that a WT Young horse? Or
I think it was an Overbrook
horse.
I think it was. I forget now, but I Yonder. Yeah. You know what I did? Years ago at Belmont, on big weekends, or maybe it was just Breeders' Cup, or maybe it was a Breeders' Cup year, or I can't remember. Down by the barbershop. And speaking of which, how is your hair? We haven't checked in on your hair. You were out of control all winter.
My mom hasn't said much because I got it cut pretty good before the second week of the Keeneland meet. Yeah,
they had those shot that like a pop up stand where they had hats with a horse already embroidered, and you could they had chestnuts, they had bays, they had grays, and you could then have a horse's name or whatever you wanted embroidered underneath, like within, you know, 10 minutes.
Yeah.
And I got Yonder. I still have it at home.
Now, you're speaking of the barbershop they used to have here?
Yeah, at Belmont. The Belmont one.
Oh, okay. Well,
but here, too.
There was one here and at Laurel, and Teddy was the barber. And he was the umpire for our softball league, and I'll never forget, he wasn't that good of an umpire because I was on second base once, and John Hartzell, who could hit a ball a mile, he hit a deep fly ball that the center fielder somehow caught. So I was ready to tag up from second and score, and I did. Well, the ball hits the center fielder's
sure.
mitt, and he bobbles it, but I had already taken off because once they made contact, well, Teddy, the umpire, said, well, no, he didn't catch it yet, and you left. I said, no. So I never forgave him for that. And poor, and he called me out. So for leaving too early,
they threw to second and appealed. Uh-huh. Appealed your
Teddy the barber. Yeah, I didn't take things like that too good back then.
You a base thrower? Did you pick the base up and throw it?
No, nothing like George Brett or Earl Weaver. You know, the Orioles coaches used to come out here all the time when Altabelli was the manager.
Sure.
And then Ralph Salbaum was the trainer, and anytime any of us from the racetrack wanted to go to the Orioles game, we went down to Memorial Stadium. That was great. I saw a no-hitter, Juan Nieves. It was April of 87 for the Brewers, and it's the one that they still show Robin Yount making the final grab on a diving catch in center field, and that was the end. That was the last out of Juan Nieves's.
How about that?
No-hitter in 87. I still got the ticket somewhere to that.
I'll give you since you threw that at us, and I was a big Brewer fan at the time, actually, Gorman Thomas and Cecil Cooper and Yount.
Molitor.
Paul Molitor.
You're a Reds fan.
I go to the games. I went to the season opener this year against the Nationals.
My buddy Doug Wagner from Cincinnati, the Warsaw Falcons, the band. He and I and his wife Patty, we had to drive to Lexington. We were supposed to go to the game, to a Reds game. And it was raining. So we said, all right, we'll drive with Patty. So we're driving back, and it's starting to clear up. And years ago at Riverfront Stadium, they didn't cancel a game until 10 o'clock at night sometimes. And it had to really be raining. You had the artificial surface, and, you know. So we're driving back, and now it's like 9 o'clock. And I said, Doug, put the game on for a second.
Put on the big one.
See if the
WLW.
Game, WLW, you bet. Desperate and dateless. And all of a sudden we hear Marty Brenneman saying, well, they're taking the tarp off. We're about 20 minutes away.
Right. So you get off the next exit.
So
we brought Patty
and her daughter home, and we hustle down. And we get there, I think, in the bottom of the first. Tom Browning pitches that perfect game.
Wow. What year was that? 90? 89?
No, it's early. It's 8. Boy, oh boy. 88, maybe?
Okay.
Because I also went to the All-Star game at Riverfront that year. I won the lottery. You remember how you'd mail in the lottery thing?
I do not remember.
For All-Star game? I went to the All-Star game and stayed actually at the Hyatt where all the All-Stars were staying.
Nice.
And there's some funny stories from that. Please, you got me sidetracked. One more. Give us something else.
I don't really know anything.
All right.
I haven't looked at anything. So I am, you know, my first Preakness here ever, I bet $100 exact at Tanks Prospect over Chiefs Ground. So I've always liked the Preakness. Pay like $26. So I got 12-1 on my money, and I was so happy that night.
You're happy almost every night. Right. Marty McGee, right, invaluable. Thank you, bud. Unbelievable. Take a break. We've got Rich Migliori and Zoe Cadman on the way. We've got Steve Haskin that is standing by, too, I think. Steve doesn't like to be put off but delayed, but we got to get the Haskin, too. Stay with us. Third hour, kind of a rollicking, kind of a wacky Thursday, Preakness Week. From Old Hilltop, back after this.
The latest racing news. It's At the Races with Steve Bick on Sirius XM Radio.
Enjoy Daily Racing Form's best value with a multi-track PP pack. Get 5 full-card PPs featuring the day's best racing for only $6. Each DRF multi-track PP pack features full-card DRF pass performances for the top tracks you want to play. Handicapping articles and analysis, closer looks for key tracks, and selections by DRF handicappers. Daily packs and longer plans for all budgets are available. Download full-card PPs for 5 of today's top tracks. Visit drf.com/multi-track today.
With 35 years at the forefront of sports technology, Stats provides next-generation sports content for basketball, baseball, football, soccer. And now, Stats is turning its sights to horse racing. RaceLens is the most in-depth product on the market. With innovative analytics powered by data from Equibase, it will change the way you follow horse racing. Stats RaceLens, bringing clarity to handicapping. Learn more at stats.com/RaceLens.
He's got a long way to go to come and get Army Mule, who's pulling away by 5.
2 years ago, Pennsylvania bred Army Mule was purchased at the Fasig Tipton Mid-Atlantic sale at Timonium. Now he's a grade 1 winner.
Army Mule, ultra impressive in the Cartery Flew Home.
There'll be more than 30 Pennsylvania breds at the Fasig Tipton 2-year-olds in training sale, May 21st and 22nd at Timonium, Maryland. Breeding and racing in Pennsylvania, it's a winner.